It feels great? Awesome. That's what I like to hear. Because, you know, I prefer that to its opposite. So if what we are doing a lot is orienting toward threat that is not actually there, or not as much there as we think, or not there in the way that we think, what are we orienting to? What is so threatening? And by and large, the thing that's threatening is actually a thought or a feeling. And in many cases, what we could say is that it's a memory of a certain kind. Whether that's like an overt memory, like, oh, I'm remembering the time somebody hit me or something. It's actually much more often a kind of implicit tone of memory. So here's a definition of trauma that is the same as a definition of karma. The Sanskrit word karma means action, and it really refers to actions taken and then their results or what played out based in them. This is really a theory of conditionality in Buddhism. But a definition of trauma. Painful stuff happened in the past where there was danger and harm. Your physiology was unable, for whatever reason, to respond fully and completely to that danger and harm in a way that felt like it could succeed at protecting itself. The incomplete nature of that response means that the muscular and we could say like sort of neurophysiological markers of nervous system activation did not leave the body. They are still with you. Trauma means you're having symptoms in the present based on past harm. So the trauma is not actually the event. Right? You may have had like a terrible life-threatening event, but you know, there was a bunch of loving people around, you were strong, you actually kind of metabolized it, you talked about it, you healed it, it moved through. And the sign that you're not traumatized by it is that you are not constantly thinking about it, and it is not running your life. It's not governing your actions. You know. So and that's subtle. Like, it's hard to discern sometimes. You know, is it, isn't it? But the thing that I'll propose is that really bad stuff can happen, and there can be the conditions for you to work through it such that it's not actually a trauma. It was a bad thing that happened, which is inevitable. Trauma means somehow your response as a physiology was interrupted or shut down or stopped or in whatever way made such that it was incomplete. So then what's happening is that when I'm responding to threat, I'm perceiving threat, negativity bias, I think things are wrong, a lot of what I'm responding to is actually internal. I feel threatened. I'm not being threatened, but I feel threatened. I'm nervous, I'm anxious, I'm worried, I'm afraid, I'm angry, I'm frustrated, I'm, you know, annoyed, I'm overwhelmed, I'm collapsed, I'm shut down. What am I perceiving? You know the feeling, like, I'm just cruising along through my day, everything's fine. And then, like, I just get a little hit of something. Like, you know, whatever. I'm walking through the grocery store, I'm having a perfectly lovely time. It's a pleasant place, there's all this good food around, I'm talking with my friend. Way down at the other aisle, I see a person quickly take out their phone and look at it. And in a flash, the mind goes, you know, any number of things, but I'll just make something up, right? Messages that come through phones. Things happen urgently. Work happens urgently. There are actually messages that I'm waiting to receive, actually, it's kind of stressful. My work is kind of stressful. Suddenly, I'm thinking about all the things that I'm late for. Suddenly, I'm thinking about being late for that deadline. Now, I'm thinking about that relationship that's embedded with that deadline that's challenging. Now, I'm thinking about the fight that I'm probably going to have with my boss. Now, I'm thinking about what might happen if I have to leave the company. Now, I'm thinking about what might happen if we have to lose our house. Now, I'm thinking about what might happen if I got a terrible illness while I had to lose my house and leave my job and respond to this deadline. You laugh. But the Buddhist word for this is papancha. It means proliferation. And in the early texts, the description is, it's as if a monkey grasping one branch swings and is already reaching for the other branch and just swings from branch to branch to branch, grasping, 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 never resting. The mind goes from one idea to the next, to the next, to the next. And the negativity bias, the red habit, means the association toward threat that, you know, it was authentically startling for me to see that person, let's say, pull out their phone and look at it. There was a little moment of unpleasant, just like pain. But I am not directly threatened by that thing. Everything after that is me, and it's internal to me, and it's my narrative, my story, my thing. And so the activation that's present, which is a trauma symptom, is in response essentially to the internal. So very often, the internal is the source of traumatic stress, ideas, fears, etc. And the external, by contrast, might be, especially if we've cultivated some conditions of safety, more pleasant. So here's then the next of these spectra. I mentioned it in the first part. The spectrum internal-external. This is one of the main things that we will work with our attention, right? Remember in the example of the meditation instructions, close your eyes and bring your attention inward. There's a preference in many of the yogic systems for inwardness of attention, withdrawal of the attention, right? Yoga teachers, what's the limb?
What's the what?
What's the limb of yoga, of the eight limbs in Patanjali? The drawing inward of attention. Pratyahara, yeah, the drawing in of the senses, right? The senses, the attention, same. Yeah, the early Indian conception of how the senses worked, like the eye, was that like an energy shot out from the eye, hooked into something, and brought it back in. Like you reach out for the image, you grasp it literally, you know. So the drawing in of that, like, oh, don't do that. Right? Don't get pulled by sensory information. And really, at the heart of this,
I can't hear, but I'm coming over here just so I can hear for a little bit.
Cool.
Okay, I'm good.
Well, yeah, do whatever works. Yeah. The paradigmatic example in the early systems, because these were celibate renunciate systems, was the response essentially to lust. Right? You're cruising along and you see passing by you the being who is the image, let's say, we'll do it in the visual, the image of the kind of thing you like, you're attracted to, whatever that flavor is for you. And what happens, right? It's just another person walking by. But it's not, because your system grasps, right? You see the image, and then there's an affect, there's an immediate hit, pleasant, you know? And it's really just, it's not just pleasant, it's just like, whoa, you know, right? The cartoons actually got it right, right? The eyes leap out of this, right? That's what happens. You see the lust object. And I'm going to keep using the word object here, even though, you know, we're not objectifying people. We have the practice of wanting to not objectify. But this is the activity of perception. Because you don't know them. They're just beautiful. And so then they're like, ping. And what happens is that the mind hooks into it and starts telling a story. You know, oh, what if we could, or I could, or maybe, you know. And then before you're even aware of it, you know, you're already kind of like standing up a little taller or kind of like, you know, manifesting your je ne sais quoi a little bit, and then like, oh, well, they're walking that way and I'm walking this way, and suddenly it becomes really the thing. It's like, oh, I'm going to go and get a coffee over there. Like, just, you know, just happen to, like, right? All of that, you know, happens all the time. But, right, what would it mean to not hook onto that thing? What it would mean from the perspective of pratyahara is that you are awake to that impact. And in the dependent origination system that I hinted at, sensory contact is depicted in there's pictorial representations for all of them, in case you're not literate. The pictorial representation of sense contact is of a man with an arrow stuck in his eye. In other words, you saw the pretty person and it went bang, right in through your eye to your brain. You know, really to somewhere else also. But, you know, the arrow in the eye. And so then the practice, in a very simple way, is to notice that, right? You can't not have contact. You're alive. You're going to have contact. You notice it, and then you're going to notice pleasant, because the vedana, the pleasant or unpleasant charge, comes immediately. And even very advanced meditators, you can't really cut that link. Things are pleasant and unpleasant, like straight up. And that's conditioning. Different things are pleasant at different times based on what you've been taught. You can learn to lust for different kinds of people, right, based on culture. But the next link, the grasping, the proliferating the mind, that only happens if you're not mindful, if you're not aware. If you're aware, then your awareness catches it. Seeing, liking, and then your discipline kicks in, and you're like, stop. Right? Now, if you happen to be shopping for a partner, and yada yada, all the conditions are right, that it's a wholesome choice to go toward that, that's something else. You're doing it intentionally. But it's not always like that. And it's very often the case that that whole mind spin is actually just a grasping at the pleasant that is ultimately painful. I'm not going to get together with that person. And these are renunciate systems. This is a beautiful way to say, like, oh, in this moment my attention got grabbed, but I can let go. And we've been talking about, like, oh, my attention gets grabbed by the perception of threat. I would say that's still the case here, even in the case of desire. The threat is something like, you know, oh my God, if I don't get together with that person, all is lost. Like, the whole world narrows to them for a moment. It's got to be that, right? It's this kind of threat. You know, I don't want to be alone. There's a deep threat embedded in the process of desiring. Yeah, and again, this is a teaching from the renunciate celibate side of the yogic systems. But it maintains all the way through, you know, the rest of the system. Even if I'm a you know, hedonistic, polyamorous tantric practitioner, and I'm like, that person could become one of my cosmic tantric partners. The tantric texts still will say, that's great, but if you desire them in a grasping way, you're not practicing. You've lost it. Right? And some texts even say you should do your cosmic tantric sexual practice with someone you're not attracted to, or who is of the wrong caste for you. Like there's no way you're going to be able to, like, marry them and settle down, like, fulfill your fantasy. Right? Do it with someone who's the wrong caste. Do it in a cemetery, which is totally unclean. You know, like, all these ways that, like, it's not going to work. So, like, let go of your fixation. It's a practice. You know, it's a wild practice.
Because the tantric practice is for the sake of meditation or whatever, not for the sake of relationship.
Right. Right. Or the relationship is for the sake of liberation, for both. I will propose, and I don't want to get into a long tangent on tantric sexual practice, tantric practice is, in all of the texts, almost entirely still sexist and patriarchal, so it's really oriented toward the man. It's not an egalitarian practice, and it's not mostly sexual. Right? The vast majority of tantra, 99.99%, has nothing to do with physical sexuality at all. And the parts that do are in the context of a radical non-duality, where it says, like, do this practice once you've achieved so much equanimity that you could eat shit or the finest delicacy and have no preference.
Yeah.
So you've already attained profound balance of the senses. And then, only then, could you go toward the most confusing of energies and hold your center. Yeah. Right? Everyone else, you have no chance. Someone comes at you with that energy, you're gone.
And is that the point? To be exposed to the most confusing, desirous, lustful energy and still be in your equanimity?
Ultimately, in some traditions, that's a very, very advanced practice. Yes. For a lot of reasons that are historical and interesting and metaphysical that we could talk about maybe on the break. We'll do you know, tantric sex talk. Most of the actual sexual practices of like withholding ejaculation and blending a white light and a red light and da da da, that's actually not tantra. It's all of that appears in early hatha yoga, and so that appears in the hatha texts. It's actually closer to the roots of modern yoga than tantra is, which is quite distant now. That's a tangent, but to say that even in the traditions that discarded the old orientation towards celibacy and renunciation, there was still this inner renunciation that was core, which is like, don't get hooked. If you get hooked, you're lost. So, back to the spectrum. For a lot of folks with trauma, meaning the past was painful and I'm still carrying it now, turning attention inward will tend to be more activating. And attention outward will tend to be less activating. And by activating, I mean triggering of nervous system response. And I'll give you the nervous system overview in a little bit. Lots of meditators know this. Lots of folks with trauma who have been told that meditation is good for stress come into meditation, find that it's terrible for them, and don't come back. Because the instruction to go inward is actually more stressful. Right? And I have totally people who come to me, they find me on a Buddhist meditation retreat, they're like, oh my God, you know, I need to tell you about my meditation practice. It's super hard. I don't know how to practice. It's so, and I listen to them, and I'm like, I say this in better clinical language with them, but basically I'm like, honey, you're traumatized. This is not the right practice for you.
Yeah.
I want you to, here's my suggestions. Run.
Yeah.
Don't go to the meditation, go to the potluck. So social activity, physical activity, get on your diet. Like, eat better, exercise, and be with people, and get outside, right? And people are like, okay, that's great, that sounds really practical. They come back, you know, a month later, and they're like, I'm really trying to sit every day. And I'm like, you didn't listen. You've absorbed an ideology from modern Buddhism and yoga that formal inward practice is better. It's not. And again, I'll reiterate that formal inward practice is, let's say, an intermediate level practice to start with. And if when a practitioner closes their eyes and goes inward, they are immediately and most of the time taken away in the river of anxious thought, then, you know, as a trauma counselor, like, don't do that. Right? That's disorganizing. You know? And so then our interventions, our instructions, are going to be tailored toward the state. This is one reason why the big public class is challenging. Because you don't know who's there, right? One person is like, I go inward, my mind opens, and the perception of the self and the infinite consciousness rests in a kind of quivering equipoise. Shiva and Shakti merge in my being like waves of bliss. I'm not actually exaggerating. That's totally a state you can get into. You might know that state. Right next to them is someone who's like, oh my God, I shouldn't have come. I'm scared. I'm not doing it right. I don't know. You know? How do you give the same instruction to both of those people? You can't. So you give a sort of generic middle ground instruction that doesn't really speak to either of their situations. Because a skillful teacher, to the second person, would be like, open your eyes, and let's walk around a little bit, and just notice that, you know, like, how are you doing? You know, did you do anything nice this week? Like, what's up? You know? But to the first person who's in Shiva Shakti, I might be like, okay, as you rest into the waves of bliss, do you discern any constriction of grasping onto the pleasure or resisting further dissolution? And if they're honest, they would be like, oh, a little bit. And I'd be like, cool. So rest in the bliss, notice that, and see if you can relax around that. And we'll come back to you in a couple hours. I'm going to be walking around with this person. You know, and that's true in yoga as well. Right? So inward, outward, internal, external. This brings us then to the other of the two foundational practices in organic intelligence. This is kind of trauma resilience work, trauma resilience work. And this is the practice that we call orientation.
John?
Yes, please.
How long can you take a break?
Shortly.
Okay.
Yeah. And you can always take it anytime.
I don't want to miss
you know. I'll repeat myself endlessly. Don't worry about it. But you could also like lay down and take a nap or, you know, do some yoga, really. You got to believe me when I say shit like that. It's actually true. When we teach the organic intelligence practitioner training, it's 4 or 6 day retreat weekends. And we always have a spot kind of behind the main part of the class or on the side called the spa, piles of blankets and cushions. And you're just encouraged to go over there and chill out anytime during the training. This is not a sit in chairs and take notes training. You can do that. You might be that type. But you can actually just hang out in the spa. And you fall asleep. You know, it's okay. The information will come in. Because the thing that we're teaching is not the information. The thing I'm hopefully teaching is that we can chill out together.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get that, then you get the whole modality. So orientation is this term that we use for technically orientation to the environment through the senses. And the senses vary, right? The visual sense tends to be the most external. Sound, which you can orient to sound, but sound can make you more internal. You know, start listening to sounds, you might close your eyes. And I sort of wash away into like the motor sound and the distant sounds. It gets really spacious. Sounds can incline toward the more internal. Same with smells and tastes, of course. And physical sensations are mixed. Am I feeling the floor or am I feeling my hand? So we'll use the visual as the initial doorway. So this is that first instruction. And the key to orientation as a practice is that we're trying to get into contact with the autonomic nervous system. Meaning the instruction isn't look around and find something pleasant. Yeah? That's super cognitive and I'm doing something. That's not going to be autonomic. And what I'm going to do, if that's my instruction, is I'm going to override something. Right? In a way, the whole point of practice is how do I figure out how to not override, but then incline the system still in the direction of the pleasure. So then here's the spin on the instruction is, let your eyes go where they want. Let your eyes go where they want. And as you practice with that, and this is a meditative practice, basically, you can start to tune into, and even folks with significant trauma can start to tune into what it might be like to observe the movement of the body and the changing sensory field rather than trying to do something about it, trying to grab onto something. So you disinhibit as the main sort of maneuver, right? And deepening in this practice essentially means doing less and less. So the practice is toward less doing, toward non-doing. And so you disinhibit the senses. You tune into the visual because it gives you a clearer sense of the external. And you tune into the environment through the senses. As you do that, so this is kind of step one. Step two is you practice toward what we'll call stabilizing blue. That's just jargon. A way of saying blue is the color we're using for ease, pleasant, safe, etc. And stabilize is really the marker of nervous system health. In other words, if I'm really anxious or vigilant or in some way out of balance, I might be able to perceive the pleasurable, but I can't hang out with it. My system won't settle, you know. And you'll totally see this in conversation with people. You'll be like, how are you doing? And somebody might be like, oh yeah, I'm pretty good. I mean, I'm really behind at work and I've got all this stuff going on with my family and my hip is hurting and my doctor's adjusting my meds and I'm really upset by the political situation, but at least we got to go hiking this weekend. But you know, it's like I just have so much to do and I didn't sleep very well that last night. Like their attention will go to that which is pleasurable, but it won't stay. And so the first intervention and this is a conversational intervention, is to get good at what we call pouncing on blue. Mm. Oh my God, my family is like this, my work is like this, at least I got to go hiking. But hey, where'd you go hiking? Mm. Right? You got to be on your toes a little bit. Because the red habit, the negativity bias, is so strong. It's so strong. And it's and this is delicate, because of course, if you completely ignore somebody's story about how bad it is, eventually they're going to feel like you're not listening to them. Mm-hmm. So you need to stay attuned. This is true for yourself as well, mm-hmm. right? I'm perceiving a lot of things, right? Some pleasant, some unpleasant. I try to stay with the pleasant, but if I completely ignore the unpleasant, I'm going to start to get worried eventually. Mm-hmm. So there's a delicacy in here. Stabilize, we could essentially use as a translation for samadhi. Samadhi is the yogic term for meditative absorption, or samapati, the coalescence, or the coming together of the mind. That's Patanjali's term. Jhana is the early Buddhist term, or dhyana, the seventh limb, absorption. The idea is that with practice, my attention can settle with something pleasurable and stay there without flickering away. And that means I have to ignore the guy pulling out his phone and the idea that I have work to do, etc. And just be like, I really like that dude's beard. And even though I have this little headache, I just really like that dude's beard. It's so cool. I remember when I had a beard like that. It's so nice. I remember that. I just get this like amazing sensation of like weight and buoyancy and fullness through the whole upper half of my being. And if I really just hang out with that, that just becomes like a perception of like the fullness of my, that's so nice. And then the image of the beard falls away, and there's just a perception of like, oh, it's kind of a kind of rich, sort of tickly presence in my whole body. Stabilized blue means you can hang out without trying too hard. For a lot of, you know, traumatized clients or folks really, really working on a healing path, orientation itself will be hard. And stabilizing blue might take a long time. I have people I'm working on this. These two first steps, these are called the initial conditions in OI. Initial conditions. Could take years. Yes, please.
The word validation, like, mm-hmm. comes up on the stabilization, because I think that if you're talking to someone, like you said, and I mean, I can think of instances for myself where I'm sharing, because I'm looking for validation.
Yeah.
And it's not that I want to sit with the negativity, but I kind of want recognition mm-hmm. of it, sort of right. like confirmation that, like, yeah, that was shitty.
Yeah.
But there was also, like, the cool hike that happened, too.
Yep.
Like, both are valid.
Yep.
But it's hard for me to stabilize in the validity
yep.
of the goodness.
Absolutely.
If I feel like there's been a bypassing.
You got it. You got it. So the person that you're relating with, the awareness that is tracking that with you, has to be attuned mm-hmm. to you enough. You know? There's totally people who come into my practice. This is me as a you know, one-on-one kind of trauma counselor, essentially. Someone will come in and they'll just be like, basically like, let me tell you my long, bad, suffering story for a long time.
Yeah.
And I know that what I really want to do is like pull out the threads of decency in it, but actually to even interrupt their story is going to rupture attunement for a while. Because some part of what they're saying is, no one ever really listens to me or will take this seriously. And so I've had people where I'm like, yep, this is what I want to do, but actually I'm totally gonna spend 10 sessions just being like, oh, I'm so sorry. Shitballs. Whoa. Man, that just hurts. Tell me more. Right? Until basically their system's gonna go through a whole arc and eventually is gonna kind of look up and be like, you're still here? It's almost like heartbreaking. You're still here. And I'm like, oh my God, like sometimes we just need to be heard. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm pinging blue. I'm like, this is pleasurable to you. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, they're like, I've never really had someone who would just like stay with me through it. And I'm like, I got you. Right? So part of the principle in dynamic systems is that both sides of the polarity are always present. And they're present in relatively equal amplitudes. In other words, super intense red is going to be paired with a super intense blue that is usually unavailable. Right? And so then your response, this is getting a little ahead of ourselves, but you know, the response that would be attuned can be attuned and still pull toward the blue. Mm-hmm. You know, oh my God, all this horrible stuff happened to me. Oh my God, that's terrible. How did you make it through? You must have been so strong. Which is not untrue, right? And they're like, you know, I just call on Jesus. And I'm like, praise the Lord. You know? And there we are. You know. And once we nail that, even for a moment, and I'd be like, cool, let's take a pause for a minute. And just like, did you see the Warriors game? You know? And then I'm going to be like, oh man, you know, nah, but LeBron is my person, you know, whatever. So, these are called the initial conditions. This is the foundation of getting out of the negativity bias, the vortex, the red spiral, the death spiral of traumatic reenactment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Things that we could call that. And this becomes the basis of all of the contemplative practices. In other words, go into your yoga practice and get oriented to the environment through your senses. Don't go in the red way, mm-hmm. right? You know, like, oh, open your eyes, open your chest, and think about the sunrise in front of you and look that way. It's good, orientation instruction. Look, see it. There's an image of a deity. Look at it. Your teacher is beautiful in spandex. Look at them. Like, whatever it is, orient outward. And then, like, if your practice feels good, go more in the direction of what feels good. Before you go in the direction of like pressing the edge of pain, right? Stabilize the pleasure of practice, and then we'll talk. So, let's take a little break. We'll take 20 for a more off leash version of the practice we did just a little bit ago. So the instruction for your break is do whatever you want. Orient outward rather than inward. Unless inward feels just right for you, in which case, orient inward. And experiment with just noticing where your attention goes. What do you pay attention to when you're walking to Berkeley Bowl or standing in line or chatting with someone? And the last thing, so basically the instruction is notice and do whatever you want. Notice, go toward pleasure. And the third of the instructions is at some point, like, say hi to somebody. Like, chat with somebody. Say hi to somebody in the course or on the street or something like that. We'll come back at 3:40, so that's exactly 20 minutes from now, and we'll go into kind of formal nervous system physiology. Thanks.
Thank you.